surrendering of a very potent mantra given by Sri Aurobindo to invoke the Supreme Divine Mother. It reads, Om Anandamayi Chaitanyamayi Satyamayi Paramayi. Like all traditional mantras, it begins with the symbol Om, which stands for the pervading reality, which cannot be expressed by any form whatsoever, but whose vibrations are most nearly represented in our human speech by this syllable Om. By repeating Om, you invoke the primal reality and link yourself with it in the depths of your being. Then it begins Anandamayi. Blissful. It is a rising moment when the human soul rises beyond this triple world of ignorance, the lower hemisphere, and enters into the higher hemisphere of the spirit. The first worlds that greet him are the worlds of bliss, ananda, delight. The divine creatrix is present there as the blissful power. It greets the seeker in her form of bliss. There is a causeless delight. It is a world full of the seas of delight. That is why the first invocation is for the mother blissful. The soul that is not content with realizing the bliss ascends still further, and it is greeted by a deeper aspect of the reality. One knows and one realizes that what one has experienced is not merely bliss, but it is something which is deeply conscious, deeply aware, taking cognizance, self-aware, all-aware. The creative puissance reveals herself as full of consciousness, as made of consciousness, whose nature is consciousness, Chaitanyamayi. The soul, the adventurous soul, climbs still further in the hierarchy of the worlds of manifest creation, and it comes across the vast of a sheer truth existence. Neither its nature of consciousness nor its expression in bliss is felt. What one is aware of a mere sheer existence of truth, that is, the Divine Mother as truth exists. Even this summit, even the three worlds of delight, of consciousness, of truth existence, do not exhaust the being, the reality that is the Divine Mother. She transcends there is still a beyond. She is free from these self-formulations of hers in the triple worlds of the higher hemisphere. She is supreme, and it is to this supreme transcendental aspect of the divine puissance, the creative force, that the last word, supreme parame, is used. To such divine puissance, to the adorable mother of all creation, let us offer our salutations. And it is our good fortune that all these four aspects of the divine manifestation, all these four poises of the divine turn towards manifestation, are embodied in her, who is our mother here today, and in whose mandir you all have the privilege to toil and work. One and at the same time, she exists on all the four levels. As she is talking to me, as the mother of bliss, looming over it, her personality as the mother of consciousness, behind it as the mother of truth, and over it as the supreme mother, all are simultaneously present. No great achievement, no consummation in yoga is possible, at any rate in this yoga of integral perfection, without a complete surrender to the divine mother. Surrender is a big term. I was once asked some years ago, it's very easy, if we just surrender, the divine is obliged to do everything for you. There is no other sadhana. But I pointed out that surrender itself is a lifelong sadhana. When we say, I am surrendering, it is nothing more than the expression of an honest intention to surrender myself. It is at best a will in my mind, supported by some aspiration in the heart to surrender. But there it remains. Unless this determination to surrender is worked out moment to moment, from plane to plane of our being, without respite, surrender remains a theory. How to surrender? In what part to surrender? That is the question. And that is the theme of our discussion today. As you are aware, ours is a yoga which has reference to all the parts of the being. That being so, the call of surrender applies to all the parts of the being. The mind, the will, the emotions, the life force, even the physical body has to learn to acclimatize itself to the climate of surrender and establish the principle of surrender in its very sense. And Sri Aurobindo points out, the one field where the surrender can be worked out most easily and most effectively is life itself. Life which covers all dynamic expression of our being. On earth, life is the chosen field. Even for one who does not do yoga, it is by experiences gained in life, experiences chosen, experiences visited upon you, that go in their accumulation to contribute to your growth. The outer being participates in so many contacts, so many impacts, and suffers, rejoices, goes on plodding, enjoying, suffering. But all the while, the inner monitor, the soul, derives the sap of that experience, not always in terms with which the external being is familiar, but in its own way. It draws the sap, the rasa as we put it in India, and grows. Ages after ages, the soul grows. Birth after birth, the soul draws through the experience of the outer being and forms itself, builds up a personality that gradually approximates and eventually reaches the Godhead. Yoga is a specialized process of speeding up this development. We do not leave it to nature to work out leisurely this evolution of the soul into its Godhead. Yoga is a selected means of accelerating, of speeding up this process of the divinization of the soul, the manifestation of the divine consciousness in the human body. For this purpose, life has to be seized at its very roots. The surrender of which we spoke has to be applied at the very roots of our daily life. In average life, 9/10 of life activity is governed, is impelled by desire. Desire has many disguises. It is not always naked desire. It works under the camouflage of altruism, philanthropy, duty, and what not. One should have the intellectual honesty to recognize desire in whatever form it poses. The first cardinal condition for effecting this surrender in integral yoga is to renounce desire. One should make up one's mind not to work impelled by desire. One shall not choose one's work under the stress of desire. One should take, particularly in an environment like this, presided over by a divine presence, that the work that comes to one is precisely what is most suited for his development. No personal preference, no mental construction or formation should influence the individual seeker in choosing his work. The choice is to be left to the divine. Once you take up this attitude of having a free and open mind to do whatever work that comes to you, The next important step is to renounce the desire for the fruit of work. It is this desire for the fruit of work that makes for impatience, for fevered effort, for fatigue, for loss of energy in work. Every moment that we work under desire, wanting a particular fruit, one eye is turned towards that, positively, negatively apprehending obstacles. One part does the work, but three-fourths of it is looking ahead at the work. This leads to fatigue in the first place. Once, I remember, the mother said, the ideal way to work is to live in the moment. The work that comes to you at the moment, live in it and do it. Don't think of the next moment. Don't think one moment ahead what is going to happen. If you can take that attitude, much of the fatigue can be avoided. Second, when you don't tie yourself to the expectation of a particular fruit, there is no tension. You develop a sense of equality. Whatever comes, you take it as the will of the Divine. To work is your part. To give whatever result is His part. Renunciation of the desire for fruit leads to a natural growth of equality of attitude. And this equality, spiritual equality in yoga, is, mind you, different from an attitude of indifference, a stoic fortitude, or a lack of interest. Equality means an unperturbed reception of what comes to you, an equal readiness to accept what is given, to have a vision of equality. When you meet anybody, this quality of equality has necessarily to be cultivated in the earlier stages. As it establishes itself, it develops into a great power which works spontaneously. But till then, equality has to be studiously cultivated. With this sterilization of equality, there is an erosion of the division of ego. Ego is normally concerned with personal aggrandizement, exploiting every situation for personal advancement. But once the desire for choice of work, the desire for the fruit of work is abandoned, the ego loses a strong foothold. With the weakening of the ego, there develops a sense of oneness with other fellow men. The divisive ego is weakened. The doors are opened for the realization of an eventual oneness. It may be asked, if one is not to exercise a choice in work, if one is not to expect a particular fruit in work, is it possible for a human being to do the work with interest? Or is it to do in a mechanical way? No. Work under these conditions ceases to be a work in the ordinary sense. it is lifted up into a sacred dimension. Work is converted into a sacrifice. It is an occasion for the outpouring of one's energies to the Master, to the Divine Mother, who governs and to whom we are making, to giving ourselves. Work becomes a means of approaching the Divine in a concrete way. It is a means for growth. With the spread of the right spirit in work, work forges a channel for the upflow of our consciousness towards the Divine. It also acts as a channel for the downflow of the Divine peace, strength, and aware consciousness in the human channel. Man begins by working as a conscious instrument. He is aware he is the doer, but he works for the Divine. The second stage is he learns to drop the doer in him, to tune himself to the Divine power, which is really the worker in the universe. He converts himself into a channel for the working of that Shakti, of the Divine power. From being an instrument, he converts himself into a channel. Proceeding in his effort of being as wide a channel, as conscious a channel as possible, there develops in him a certain identification with the power that flows. Love, devotion, self-giving, all these have their own contribution in enlarging the area of this identification with the Divine Shakti. The final step is when the worker ceases even to be a channel, but becomes one with the universal power that works, is no more than a point of radiation. He is one with it. He has no separate will. His will becomes a fulcrum for the operation of the universal will on earth. This, in short, in outline, is the gospel of works as developed by Sri Aurobindo from its adumbration in the Bhagavad Gita. Sri Aurobindo refers with great feeling to the Gita as the first broad and large statement of the gospel of works ever given to man. I do not know how many of you are aware that the Gita has played a remarkable part in the spiritual manifestation of both Sri Aurobindo and the Mother. To those of you who are not familiar with the topic of Gita, I would only mention that the Gita purports to be a discourse between Lord Krishna, the avatar of the age, and Arjuna, the fighting prince, in the Mahabharata war, who Arjuna, the representative man, on the eve of the decisive battle, the battle which was fought for 18 days, when both the hosts were assembled and standing ready to go into action, Arjuna, the leading prince, who was leading the hosts of the righteous princes, he sees in the opposite camp his own teachers, his own sars, his own relations, whom he has to kill. A false sense of pity, compassion comes over him, and he drops his bow and arrow and tells his companion charioteer, Lord Krishna, that he would not fight. It is then that Lord Krishna begins a discourse which runs into 18 chapters, covering a vast gamut of spiritual life. The main theme being the gospel of works. How man has a duty to God, which is much more than his duty to fellow men, to his family, to his country. It is a big subject which shall not detain us here. But the Karma Yoga, as it has been known all over the world, in whatever name, has its basis in this dialogue between Krishna and Arjuna. The mother has said in one of our conversations that long ago, when she was in France in her younger days, when there was a crisis in her inner life, she did not know in which way to turn. She wanted very much to know something of the Eastern wisdom, spiritual wisdom, and she was waiting. It was then that by some mysterious way, one Indian patriot who happened to be there placed in her hands a French translation, a very unsuccessful French translation of an English rendering of the Gita. And she describes how much she benefited by reading the Gita. She had occasion to mention this when she remarked how in the ashram we take things for granted. We don't have to struggle for spiritual guidance. We don't have to make any physical effort and tapasya to get spiritual knowledge as the ancients had to, as even Mother and Sri Aurobindo had to. It is there for the asking. We have only to receive it. And she remarked with a certain poignancy that things are there, but the eyes are turned elsewhere. Regarding Sri Aurobindo, it was when he was in Alipur jail for one full year, when he was imprisoned under false charges, that he studied deep into the Gita. It was while he was reading the Gita that he had the experience, the revelation of the universal Godhead, Vasudeva. Vasudeva means the God who is everywhere. It is Krishna who is everywhere. He saw the Lord, the universal Lord, around him, above him, in all people, in the court, in the yards, everywhere. And he asked him not to have a moment's care about the trial. I have been working on a small book collecting together all the Sanskrit references in Sri Aurobindo's writings in English, and then tracing their originals in the various Sanskrit scriptures or classics. And to my amazement, I find that at least 50 to 60% of his citations are from the Gita. This will give you an idea of the importance of Gita. There have been hundreds of commentaries on the Gita from various points of view. Even today people are writing. It is a living fountain of spiritual inspiration. But the one exposition that is most suited to the modern mind, most helpful for gaining an entry into the secrecies of integral yoga, he is sharing those essays on the Gita. If you have not read, I would very much recommend that next to the synthesis, it is essays on the Gita that should be read and reread. I think I have covered the main theme that I had in mind, and we can devote the next 10 minutes for any questions that any of you may be disposed to ask.
Is it possible to, like in Yasa, you mentioned the word, I think it's Swahava, the law of the nature, the being. Isn't it possible to do a work that follows the law of your being, that you have a tendency towards?
One is purified of the sediment, of the film of lower nature, that the real Svabhava, the real mold of the being comes forth, and you are shown what is your field of action, what is your way of growth. Things are not determined by birth, by heredity. At any rate, in spiritual life, it is the Svabhava of this embodying soul that should be the deciding factor. As society declined, this Svabhava came to be determined by the particular class, by the particular caste in which men were born. But that is not what was in earlier ages of India. It is only the teacher who could determine the real Svabhava of the individual and prescribe to him the particular sadhana. That could take him to his height. At any rate, in our integral yoga, we have to orientate our nature to the goal, in the direction of the goal. Each man, if you look it from a deeper angle, has four natures, not one. Just as there are four powers of the Divine Mother, there are four powers of the human personality. It will not do for one who seeks integral perfection to arrive at the perfection of the knowledge element alone, the perfection of the heroic element alone, or of the harmonizing and productive element alone, or of service alone. All the four have to be forged into one unity. The Gita represents a certain stage in the development of human thought. Much has happened thereafter. The concept of the supramental consciousness, the concept of the Gnostic life, these are not there in the Gita, because the human mind was not ready for it. Each scripture, take it from me, it gives just what the humanity is ready for and a little ahead to drag them further. Each age has its scripture, but the past scriptures have always a message for the man who is still psychologically in that stage.
Can we say that according to the karma yoga, as you explained, or the integral yoga, each work, or the work itself, which we do, is indifferent. That is, the attitude which we do it, the surrender, and so on. But
indifference? No. Work has to be done with interest. But indifference applies to the result.
No, excuse me. Indifferent, I mean, whatever work you do, whether it is writing a book or
The nature of the work.
All work is sacred. It is a mental notion making one work superior and one work inferior. All work entails an outpouring of energy at whatever level. So this outpouring of energy must be a sacrifice to the divine. Whether you write a book, whether you clean a floor, when you do it in consecration, there is a growth of the inner consciousness by 1 inch. Whatever work you do, if you are just a mental thinker, you can write 100 volumes and your consciousness may not grow spiritually. Mentally it may form itself, but spiritually it may not add even 1 inch. Whatever you do, it should be, each work is an occasion for the culture of the consciousness in the way of self-consecration.
Still have the feeling, but maybe in a mental idea or feeling, that working, for instance, on the matrimony view, has an added dimension in the work itself.
That is true. That is true. Certain works have a special significance. Only those who are ready to benefit by that situation benefit from it. For anybody else, even if you have to work in Matrimandir, in the normal egoistic spirit it won't help. Perhaps the indirect vibrations may awaken him sometime, but it is the attitude. Such favorable circumstances, specially charged environments, are provided for souls who are ready to benefit by it. One shall not miss the occasion. There are, just as on earth, there are concentrations of beauty, concentrations of power, concentrations of spiritual energy. Though in theory all are same, all is God's manifestation, but in practice there are deliberately designed concentrations, and there the chosen souls are attracted and brought so that they take the leap or they are uplifted. Matrimandir, I have no doubt whatever, is one such capital concentration of power, giving a vast opportunity to the aspiring souls. It is not just work. I agree that with the same spirit of dedication, surrender, you may work a mile separately and here. One will always gain more here, because the concentration of forces is different. But it is not everyone who is circumstanced to work here. Then I think one anecdote.
Are there other true indications when one is working than the joy of creation which the psychic feels? Are there other indications
yes.
which are not mental, which are certain and true?
There is no fatigue. Of course, if you work too much, there is a certain physical fatigue, but normally there is no fatigue, there is no sense of time. One is carried in a stream. There is an ebullition of that feeling, what you said, and there is no fatigue. When Mother says, when there is fatigue, look into yourself and see why there is fatigue. Where is the failing? Where the right attitude has failed? That is the thing. I think we shall close with one or two anecdotes about the mother. As you all know, she is a stickler for perfection. Herself, she is never satisfied. Always she wants to go a little ahead. She expects the same from those around her, from those who aspire for an ultimate perfection. It was years ago when she was visiting the various services turn by turn. So one of the departments had just been started, And I think for their first anniversary or so, they had requested mother to pay them a visit. And as she, when she was to come, they had tidied up everything, arranged spick and span, arranged things, almirahs, everything. And they were all waiting at the gate. Mother's car came, somebody opened the door, mother got in. She looked like this. Just then the offices, arrangements for prasad, distribution, flowers were this side. She got in and they all were showing this way. She turned that way. You know, she turned on the right and went straight to what looked like a garage, old garage. And she went and just lifted the door. And there were old coconut shells, coconut fibers and all that, all heaped up pell-mell. Then naturally, at that time, they felt very sorry that they had arranged such things in such a clumsy way and mother saw it. They naturally felt unhappy. But nobody could ask mother why she did it. After she returned, someone asked mother, why did you do that? She said, I didn't mean to do it. As soon as I stepped in, she said, I heard. Look at us, how they have placed us here. And then she went. She had no idea what was inside. She opened and she saw these things. So thereafter, naturally, everybody was doubly careful. Similarly, when I believe our blanchisserie, how do they call it in English?
Laundry.
Laundry was started. It was, for the first few weeks, it was, people used to take the laundered clothes, first batch, to show to her. For a few days it was done like that, so that she could see the kind of work that was done and say something she would see. So these people had taken a lot and they took it to her and put her on her seat. Mother, instead of seeing, she took out one in the middle. On that there was a patch, you see, a brown patch. And she asked how it remained. Now, either they had not noticed it, or it was not noticed too late and they had put it in the middle because mother would never see it. See, the thing is, the consciousness, the divine consciousness, spontaneously takes cognizance of things. It does not need a mental effort to note or grasp them. It instinctively, what we call instinct, it's not instinct there, we may say intuitively. It is a spontaneous flow of the consciousness. So what should be done, what should be seen? I think that's enough for the day.